You are listening to Winning with Mainstay. The opinions expressed on this edition of Pensacola Expert Panel are not necessarily those of News Radio 92.3 AM 1620, but rather the opinions of the sponsor, Mainstay Financial Services, with host Bob Burgi.
Yes, it's time to talk some money with our dear friend, Bob Burgi. Bob, good morning.
Good morning, Jenna. How are you?
I'm so excited because it's a beautiful day and we get to hang out today.
That's right.
So,
for 1 hour.
I'm very thankful.
What could be better?
Well, we brought a friend. That's what could be even better. It's a party in here now.
We have with us today attorney Nicholas Medley, and we are going to talk about estate planning. Planning your estate. And all things estate planning related. So tune in. It promises to be very exciting.
And absolutely. And if you have a question, 850-437-1620. If you're looking to take notes, now is your time to grab your pen and paper. And of course, good morning. Do you like to be called Nicholas?
Nick is fine.
Nick. All right. We're friends now. Whatever. Nick. Okay. We're hanging out.
That's
we're
right.
Crack a beer and just chill and talk some estate planning, which isn't always an easy subject to bring up. We've talked about this before.
Yes. Yeah, we've got some great stories. Nick and I have, encountered a lot of, what do you think, mistakes or possibly learning opportunities for our listeners, right?
Learn opportunities for the listeners, not so much learning for the people who actually made the mistakes.
Yeah. No, we don't identify any people, but we've certainly, been around the block a little bit and have seen some things to look out for. And, with that, let's just begin the program. The first thing about estate planning is it is a plan, right? You have to have a plan. And as they say, what do they say, Jenna? Failing to plan
is planning to fail. Yeah.
Right?
Right.
So
in all things in life.
Yeah. And guess what else? Guess what else? Who needs an estate plan?
Everybody.
Why?
Because we're all going to kick the bucket.
We're all going to take a dirt nap one day, right? But anyway,
that's a good one. I like that one.
Yeah. So anyway, you got to have a plan, and I think that's something that you know who you love, you know who your loved ones are,
right.
You know what the causes you believe in are, if you're charitably inclined.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to have a plan, and you have to have a resource, an advocate. You have to have somebody to draft the documents to put your plan in place, okay? And that's where an estate planning attorney comes in. And I think it's Nick, would you say it's a very narrow area of practice?
I would say so. I mean, like anything else, you can dabble in it, but actually know what you're talking about and everything, it's a very narrow area of practice. And I'm also an elder law attorney as well, which means my focus is not just estate planning, but also focusing on elder law issues like Medicaid, helping people protect assets if they need to qualify for Medicaid while going into a nursing facility, that sort of thing, and planning for that eventuality.
Okay, so asset protection. And when do you see folks doing that? Is it mainly senior citizens?
It's mainly senior citizens, and sadly, most of the time it's crisis planning. It is, someone has had a stroke or whatnot and winds up in a nursing facility, and their children come to me and say, we need to get mom qualified for Medicaid the next week or something, and it's all hands on deck, try to get it done. No one ever does it in advance, sadly.
Exactly. And you have the look backs. You have
5-year look back.
Yeah.
Right.
You have some things you just can't work around. You don't have a time machine. But I'm very familiar with that. So you're an estate planning attorney and an elder law attorney, and that's pretty much what you have built your practice around.
Yes, sir. Those and probates, helping probate estates upon people's passing, actually putting their estate plans into practice.
Right. So. Right. So seeing through their estate plan.
Right.
I gotcha. Okay. So again, number one, you have to have a plan, right? And you need to have an estate planning attorney draft the documents to affect your wishes, okay? Let's talk, Nick, about the order and, the disposition of assets at death and how that takes place. And I think you and I have talked about this before, and I think everything falls into three buckets, if you will, or three silos. The first being, you know, the most powerful form of transferring assets at death is by, of course, title. Anything that you own jointly with the joint owner, joint with right of survivorship, will pass to the survivor. No questions asked. You produce a death certificate and, of course, the driver's license, you know, for yourself. And in most cases, those assets are going to be transferred into your name. Another form of asset transfer by title is, of course, accounts that are titled TOD or POD, transferable on death, payable on death. Again, that passes by title, really cannot be contested in any way, shape, or form. It passes by title to the people named as under the transferable on death or payable on death provisions of the title. So very, very powerful form of transferring assets at death. The second is beneficiary designation. And Nick, do you want to cover that area?
Sure. Beneficiary designation is just when you have an account, whether it's something like an IRA or 401k, where you can name a pay on death beneficiary. Mm-hmm. And you know, a lot of people name their spouses or their children as beneficiaries. And again, those are automatically, but upon the death of the owner, you just go to the company, give them the death certificate, present your own identification, and they'll pay out to you as the beneficiary. It passes without need of probate or anything, which is a big plus for a lot of people because a lot of people want to avoid probate if, at all costs.
Yeah, and we should say that assets that transfer by title or by beneficiary designation avoid probate.
Yes.
And that's huge. So again, and I think you mentioned retirement plans, all retirement plans, IRAs, 401ks, Roth IRAs, 403bs, 401as, they all have a beneficiary designation, and whoever you name as primary beneficiary will receive those assets as long as they have survived you. It also makes sense to name contingent beneficiaries just in case those folks do not survive you. Other assets that pass by primary beneficiary designation: annuities, life insurance proceeds. What else?
You can even name, depending on the bank or financial institution, you can even name some individual accounts, checking or savings or CDs or things like that can also have beneficiary designations on them as well.
Right. Right. Okay. But certainly all retirement assets,
right,
and annuities, life insurance contracts pass by primary beneficiary designation. That leaves the last bucket or silo, if you will, the first two being title, second, beneficiary designation, and the third being, what do we call that?
Everything else.
Everything else. Okay. And I like to look at it like this. If you have an asset and it is not titled jointly, doesn't have a TOD or POD designation in the title, or it does not have a primary beneficiary designation within the contract of the asset, then it's typically in the name of the deceased and in their name only.
Right.
And that passes, of course, by their last will and testament, if they have it. And if they don't have a last will and testament, heaven forbid, per the laws of intestacy,
right,
in the state that person was domiciled. So, do you want to share with our listeners your thoughts about that?
Sure. Well, either way, it's important to make the distinction that whether it's through a will or via intestacy, it goes through probate either way.
Right.
A lot of people have the mistaken assumption that if they have a will, they get to avoid probate somehow.
Mm-hmm.
But the will is just kind of like an instruction manual for the probate judge that tells the judge, this is whom I want to be in charge of my estate, and this is where I want my assets to go.
Right.
Whereas if you die without a will and goes intestate, then your assets go to whomever the state deems your close relatives, and that may not be how you want your estate to go, which is the importance of having a will in the first place.
Yes.
It doesn't avoid probate, but it does give you a large measure of control over your estate.
Right. Sort of a hyper-probate is dying without a will. Certainly it makes it more arduous, more, there's no instruction manual, as
right,
you said. And, I always like to say this. I think a lot of folks place an inordinate amount of emphasis on avoiding probate.
Right.
And I have seen where assets pass per the terms of the deceased's last will and testament, and it's worked out beautifully. Now, it takes a little longer, but there is that cooling off period, and, you know, look, probate takes some time.
Right. The average probate, and depends on it which state, because every state has a different probate code, mm-hmm. and it depends how this goes. In Florida, the average probate can take about 7 months from start mm-hmm. to finish. A lot of that is a 90-day period in the middle that you just have to publish the notice to creditors by law and then wait for the creditors to have a chance to file claims against the estate. And the rest of it just how long it takes paperwork to go through the court system and whatnot.
Right.
But probates in Florida are generally not that bad. The only thing that can make probates really dried out is when you have beneficiaries fighting over whatever, you know, the assets of the estate. That's what makes probates a nightmare, or right. can make probates a nightmare. But generally speaking, in Florida, probates are okay as long as everyone's in agreement and willing to get along with each other.
Yeah. And, you know, I think a lot of times we see people come in, they say, look, I really want to avoid probate. How do I do this? Okay. And let's say it's a single person, okay, but they have children. And they want to leave everything to their children. And their objective is to avoid probate. Well, they may not need probate. You know, or excuse me, they may not need a trust, okay? And probate is okay. But, you know, what we'll do is we will share with them that, you know, this is what happens if you have a trust and you may not need it. You know, the kids are doing well. You don't have any estate tax issues. And we'll talk more about who needs a trust. There's no second marriage here. There's no privacy concerns. So, all of the reasons to have a trust do not exist. And, you know, that's when you take these people and say, look, this is all probate is. You need a will, but it's going to be pretty clean. It's going to be pretty smooth. And guess what else? You have this time where, you know, perhaps the kids can be coached a little bit and you can share this information little by little, and you know, by the time the probate estate is finalized and everything is in under the ownership or in the accounts of the kids, they're ready for it.
Right.
Yeah. So, all right. So let's talk about some of the estate planning documents, specifically advance directives. Mm-hmm. By definition, what is an advance directive? It's kind of a cool name.
Advance directive is, a lot of people used to call it a living will. Advance directives, these are documents that lay out how you want to be treated, what care you want to receive should you be in certain situations.
Right.
And I would say one of the most important documents I prepare is not a will, not a trust. Those are very important, don't get me wrong. But one of the most important I do is a power of attorney.
Right.
Because powers of attorney are documents that say who you want to be in charge of managing your assets, financial assets, and your health care decision-making if you are alive but incapacitated.
Right.
And the reason why that's so important is if something happens to you, like a car accident or a stroke or heart attack or whatnot, it's much more likely to incapacitate you than it is to outright kill you.
Right.
And when you're incapacitated, if you're laid up in the hospital and you're either unconscious or you're awake but you're not mentally capable of managing your own affairs, you want to have someone in place to be nominated to be able to take care of things for you. Because if you don't, it can lead to absolute chaos.
Right. Exactly. And we're going to talk more about advance directives. But really, I consider advance directives the living will.
Right.
As we say, DNR, do not resuscitate. If you're in a vegetative state, really the living will allow you to expire.
Right. The living will basically says that in the event you're in a coma or persistent vegetative state, and two doctors say that you're not coming out of that state, do you want to be kept alive artificially? Yes or no?
Right.
That's the living will in its most basic form.
Durable power of attorney, where you deputize somebody in advance, it's an advance directive, to act on your behalf, really on matters concerning your finances.
Right.
Paying your bills, just anything financially related or even legally related,
and
day-to-day operations.
If I can break you for just a moment, I will say, and I see this happen a lot, a lot of people will put their children's names as joint owner on their accounts to be able to give them the authority to access the accounts, pay bills and everything. I agree, don't get this for two reasons. That's why you should make their child a power of attorney if you want them to do that.
Right.
Because if you put someone as a joint owner on the account, then number one, as I said earlier, if you were to pass away, then all that account becomes the child's, just right. That child. And maybe that's not what you want to have happen to the money in that account.
Right.
And also it imparts legal liability. If you put your child on as joint owner of the account, and a week later that child runs a red light and hits someone, gets sued, all of a sudden your account can be up for grabs in their lawsuit.
Right.
Because you put your kid's name on it.
Right. Okay. And I see that a lot. I'm gonna put my son or daughter or both on my joint checking account. And I always say this, no big harm or foul there, as long as that's your operating cash account. And let's say, those are your only two children, okay,
right.
Because they're going to get more because it's owned jointly. But where it goes afoul is when that checking account has a lot of money in it,
right,
and there's other beneficiaries, possibly other siblings, and you named the one that lives down the street, and all of a sudden they get all this money. Let's say the actual owner of the account dies, and it goes to the joint owner, and this person is receiving more than their siblings, and you've got gifting issues if they want to make it right. That's a whole other ball of wax, but I usually say if it's your operating account to pay the bills, to get things taken care of, sort of an operating account, and you're keeping $5,000-$10,000 in there, no big deal.
Right. It's when it's their major savings account or whatnot. Where there's a lot of money that's sitting in there. That's the issue.
Right. We're talking about estate planning. For our listeners, if you have a question, a comment, or if you'd like to share a story with Nick and myself, please give us a call. The number is 850-437-1620. All right. We got advanced directives taken care of, okay? Living will, durable power of attorney, and appointment of healthcare surrogate. And, of course, the appointment of healthcare surrogate to me is that person doesn't need to be necessarily financially savvy, but they need to know enough about the issues that might be taking place with you physically to make a decision on your behalf.
Right. And a lot of people think that they have to have the same person for both jobs. Their durable power of attorney has to be their healthcare surrogate. That's not the case.
Right.
I have a client who has two children. One's an accountant and one's a nurse.
Yeah.
Guess which one she made the durable power of attorney, which one she made the healthcare surrogate?
Durable power of attorney is the accountant. And, exactly. Of course, the healthcare surrogate is the nurse. Yeah. I've seen that over and over and over. You know what? Before we leave advanced directives, Nick, I want to talk about possibly the dangers or maybe a word of caution in naming concurrently, children or anybody to serve as power of attorney, and share with us your thoughts on that.
Right. Well, of course, when you name someone as a power of attorney, I always encourage folks to have a backup in place. For example, you can have your spouse as your primary agent, then your child as a backup, or your brother or sister as a backup, whatnot. A lot of parents ask if they can name their kids as co-powers of attorney. And I usually recommend against that, because let's say you get into a car accident, you're laid up in the hospital, child A wants to do one thing, child B wants to do a different thing. Well, if they're both co-powers of attorney and the document gives them the authority to act independently of each other, which most of them do, then they're both legally right.
Yeah.
And then you have a court case on your hands where
right.
they each try to go to a judge and try to argue why they are making the right decision on behalf of their parent.
Yeah.
And it just becomes a god-awful mess.
And then you have the client that says, okay, well, I've actually got three children, so I'll have a tiebreaker in there. Still doesn't work
no.
like you want. I mean, nobody is ever going to agree. Name that one person that you trust and you have figured out is going to be able to act on your behalf. Go with that person. Certainly name a backup, but naming children specifically concurrently, I've seen that turn into a disaster.
Yes, same.
So that also goes for you weigh in on this, Nick. Would you say the same is true in naming your personal representative under your last will and testament?
Mostly. There's a bit less of a risk with personal representatives just because they are bound to act within the boundaries of the will, within the four corners of the will. They have to do what the will says they have to do.
Right.
Whereas with the power of attorney, they are more freewheeling in their authority to act on their behalf.
Right.
So it's less of a bad idea with powers with personal representatives in the will, because they are bound in what they can and can't do. But still, it's just easier most time to have a primary and then a secondary, then even a tertiary. You can go as many levels deep as you want to. I've prepared wills for people that have eight names, line of succession style.
Right.
But, I mean, that's the way I usually recommend doing it.
Right. And especially, let's say you don't have children, and all of your you know, your the people you trust are your contemporaries, and they're about the same age as you. You know, you may want to go down the line pretty far,
right?
Because the people that are your age, there's a greater likelihood or probability that they could predecease you than perhaps your children,
exactly.
You know, a generation removed. So anyway, you know, I like those comments, and I would dare say that the only time I see where concurrent serving really works is in the case of, say, a revocable living trust, and you have a husband and wife,
mm-hmm.
Because, you know, their objectives are usually perfectly aligned.
Usually,
right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So so anyway, that's you know, that's something to think about. And one of the things that I think our listeners should know is you can't go in and see Nick or any estate planning attorney and really have Nick share with you who should serve. You kind of need to have that figured out to get Nick up to speed on the family dynamics of your children and what they excel in. You know, it's really not going to be Nick's decision. You can tell me, you know,
right.
You can tell Nick about where they excel. They may be savvy in this area and not so much another area, and he can make a recommendation, but that's got to be your decision.
Yeah, I've had a lot of people ask, so well, who do you think I should name? And I say, ma'am, it's not my call. It's not my will.
And then they'll
know?
Say, can you serve, Nick? And
no.
Say, no. You know, I can't draft the document and name myself, you know. But, no, actually, I have seen that before. But anyway, as far as naming somebody in advance directives, in a trust, or your personal representative or executor in other states to serve, to settle your estate in your last will and testament. Yeah, spend a lot of time thinking about that, discussing it with, you know, the people around you that are important, and possibly even the person you're going to name.
Definitely.
Yeah. Okay, so here's the big one. We've talked all around it. When should somebody consider having a trust?
Well, trusts are they're a tool, just like a tool like a hammer, for example. A hammer is great for fixing certain issues, but it's not great for every problem in your house.
Right.
Trusts are similar. They're great when you have children who you have concerns about. Maybe you don't want them to receive assets outright when you pass away because they have issues with drug addiction or whatever problems they may have. Or maybe they're just not very good at managing money and you want to save them from themselves. They're good for second marriage situations where you want to provide for your spouse after you pass away, but you also want to make sure that your children from your prior marriage are taken care of. They are great for privacy concern reasons if you have something in your estate that you don't want to be part of a public probate. They're great, and this is especially true for our area of Florida. They're great if you own property in multiple states, because we have a lot of people here who have retired here, but they still have property in Michigan or Minnesota or Wisconsin or wherever they move from up north. And if you pass away owning property in two states, you have to do two probates. One probate here in Florida, and then what's called an ancillary administration or an ancillary probate in the other state where property is located.
Yeah.
Whereas having a trust can avoid that mess.
Yeah. How often do we see where somebody goes or comes to you, they do need a trust, you draft the trust for them, the trust is executed, and then what else do you need to do?
You have to fund it.
You have to fund it, yeah. And what better assets to fund that revocable living trust than property out of state, which will avoid an ancillary administration or ancillary probate in that state. You know, if one of the objectives is probate avoidance in having a revocable living trust drafted for you, then why not go ahead and get it funded? Because,
exactly.
Again, as we discussed earlier in this show, anything that is in your name and your name only, or perhaps in yours and your wife's name, entitled jointly, the survivor or the sole owner, if it's titled in that person's name only, is going to have a probate estate for that asset. And it's not something that's pleasant in one state, and certainly not in multiple states. We see this a lot because we live in Florida. We are going to the news.
Yeah, we're
going to thanks for the
just
warning.
Pause. That was good. You were on a roll, and my hands were flying, but we're...
Don't worry. I'm looking at Nick, not you.
No, you're
okay,
fine.
Mark.
All right, well, hello.
What's new in the world?
I'm Jennifer Koshinko with Your Money Now. Stocks are slumping as government bond yields jump. The Dow Industrial's down 457 at 34,403. The NASDAQ's down 387. The S&P 500 down 81. For now, Bridgerton Season 1 is the most watched program ever on Netflix, but the streaming service says that's likely to soon change. Netflix says Squid Game, a Korean language survival story launched earlier this month, is on target to be its most successful series ever. The show's already attracting a far larger audience than the French language crime drama Lupin, which was the first non-English language show to become the top program on the site. CVS is adding anti-theft safes to its Texas pharmacy locations to prevent drug misuse and diversion. The company already added the time delay safe technology to 223 Houston locations, including those inside Target stores, in order to prevent pharmacy robberies. In 2015, the safes were first added to Indianapolis pharmacies. That's Your Money Now.
Wonder if you should get tested for colorectal cancer? Well, it's the second leading cancer killer in the U.S., and screening helps prevent it. So if you're 50 or older, it's time. Even if it doesn't run in your family, most often, colorectal cancer occurs in people with no family history. And it doesn't always cause symptoms, especially early on, so don't wait for symptoms to get tested. Screening helps prevent the disease by finding precancerous polyps so they can be removed. Remove the polyp, prevent the cancer. Screening also helps find colorectal cancer early when treatment works best. You might be thinking, oh no, not that test. But here's the thing, you have options. There's more than one screening test. Talk to your doctor to find the one that's right for you. No more excuses. If you're over 50, get tested, because colorectal cancer screening really does save lives. A message from HHS and CDC's Screen for Life campaign.
You know more about what matters in your life because you listen to the Pensacola Expert Panel with Jenna Barr. 9 till 11 weekdays on News Radio 92.3 AM 1620.
This is Bob Burgi. I'm with Mainstay Financial, and I have with me today Mr. Nick Medley. Nick is an estate planning and elder law attorney with his practice here in Pensacola, Florida. Nick, anything interesting about yourself that you'd like to share? Tell us about yourself personally a little bit.
Sadly, I'm a little boring. I grew up in Bonifay. It's many of you know it's a little town about an hour and a half east of here, more cows than people. Spent my entire life in Bonifay, went to undergrad and law school at the University of Florida. Go Gators.
Gator.
And I've been in practice here since 2013, and I'm a solo attorney. My wife is a chaplain at Sacred Heart Hospital in downtown, and we have two young sons, Wesley, who is 5, and Connor, who will be 3 in December.
Terrific.
And that's about the long and short of it.
Yeah, and I'll bet you have an estate plan, right?
Oh, of course. Well, yeah, I always say doctors are their own worst patients, attorneys are their own worst clients.
That's right. Okay, so listen, we have talked about a lot of things. First of all, having a plan, choosing an estate planning attorney, and we want to talk a little bit more about that. But the order of disposition of assets at death, how that works by title, by primary beneficiary designation, or that third bucket we talked about, per the terms of your last will and testament or dying intestate, meaning without a will. Okay, we also talked a little bit about probate, choosing who will serve under advanced directives or possibly your trust or last will and testament. And then when a trust should be considered. And our list is about 5 scenarios, I'd say. Certainly for privacy. A trust is very private. You know, you don't submit a trust document to probate,
right?
Okay, because everything under the terms of the trust that is in the trust escapes probate. So it can be a very private document. Also great for second marriages, especially with children from a prior marriage. And we'll talk about a little bit more about that. If you have a child with issues, special needs, maybe some adolescent issues that they just haven't grown up yet, maturity issues.
Exactly.
Does that work?
Yeah.
Okay. Or you have somebody that's a spendthrift, just can't manage their money. or might be financially irresponsible. Out-of-state property is another big one, and we talked a little bit about that. And then one that we don't see as often because the estate tax exemption is so high, estate tax avoidance. So we don't see that as often, but certainly it's a scenario where a trust would be appropriate. Okay, we're going to talk now about the infamous estate tax exemption. It's high, okay? A lot of most estates, most people do not have an estate tax liability. That's something that may change, and we're going to talk a little bit more about that later. But tell us about the current estate tax exemption, Nick.
Well, the estate tax exemption is $11,700,000, I believe. It is currently set to sunset back down to its previous levels around 2025, but given the current administration, it probably will go down sooner rather than later.
Right, right. We got a lot of things to pay for, right?
Yeah, a lot of COVID relief funds, a lot of everything.
Yeah, this infrastructure bill. There's a lot of things, and I think, you know, honestly, some of the low hanging fruit in terms of tax revenue is the estate tax exemption. So the estate tax exemption coming down means there will be a greater estate tax liability.
Right.
And, you know, this is purely speculation, but I've heard figures as low as $2.5 million to as high as somewhere around $3, $4, $5 million. And is that about where you're hearing?
Yeah, I've been hearing more around the $4 to $5 million mark.
Okay.
You know, that's
okay.
Same
so a lot of us, you know, a lot of estates, a lot of us will escape the federal estate tax. So we don't want to spend a whole lot of time talking about what could be. We'll talk about what is right now. And the federal estate tax exemption right now is $11.7 million. So very few estates are subject to tax. And, of course, in the state of Florida, we don't have much to worry about on the state level in estate taxes,
right,
or inheritance taxes. They don't exist. All right. So that's about all there is on the federal estate tax exemption. I do want to say it's an interesting history. As recently as, what was it, 1997, 1998, that sounds like a long time ago, you know, 23 years ago, the federal estate tax exemption was $600,000. Mm-hmm. It slowly went up by $25,000. But that means anybody with a taxable estate in excess of $600,000 was paying federal estate taxes. You know, that's hard to believe.
Yeah, especially in the current exemption.
Yeah, and now it's doubled how many times? So it went up slowly, and again, it's at $11.7 million right now. Nothing to worry about, but stay tuned. Again, the sunset provision is 2025. I don't think we'll get there. What do you think, Nick?
No, we're not. It'll go down definitely before 2025.
Exactly. Okay, so we're going to talk now about beneficiary designations, when to perform a beneficiary designation audit. You know what? And I would say doing it at least annually is probably not a bad idea. But what are some of the instances, Nick, that would trigger a beneficiary designation change?
So you might want to think about changing beneficiaries when there are major life events, upon mm-hmm. the birth of a new grandchild or a new relative you want to make sure is provided for, upon someone's death, upon a marriage or a divorce, any kind of major life event of you or your immediate family should make you go back and say, is this estate plan still how I want it to be? Is this still how I wanted people to be provided for? And like I said, annual checkup is never a bad idea.
Right. We have clients that will, you know, let's say they bypass their children. Their children are doing well, and they say, you know what, leave it to our kids, you know.
Right.
So they want to leave it to their grandchildren. Well, the nice thing about a trust or a will is you can leave it to a class or a generation of beneficiaries. You know, let's say all the, you know, the children and unborn children of my three children, right?
Right.
So my grandchildren, whoever they may be, and whoever is born after I execute this document, the
right.
trust or the will. You do not get the same latitude. You don't get the same pass with beneficiary designations in your IRA, in your 401k, your 403b, your 401a, your 457bs, the annuities, life insurance proceeds. You need to go back and add these people as they're born.
Exactly.
So certainly the birth of a child, birth of a grandchild. You want to go back and look, see, and see if who you've named and if they need to be added. The death of a loved one, or let's say somebody that you've already named as a beneficiary, you certainly want to change it after that.
Exactly.
Another big life event, unfortunate life event, well, there's two, divorce and death. We covered birth, death, and now divorce. How many times? Let's go ahead and cover it. Do we see where a divorced couple do not go back and change their beneficiary designations after the divorce is final?
I've seen it happen a lot, unfortunately.
All the time. And, you know, that's why you need to, number one, keep your own personal financial statement. You need to have some sort of identifier of what has a primary beneficiary designation. And, you know, once a year or when some sort of life event takes place, you want to go back and make those changes. Let's talk about per stirpes. Explain what that means. I see, and let me share this with you. Most retirement plans, most annuities will have a little box that will say per stirpes. A lot of times it's checked. A lot of times it's not. Do you want to explain that, Nick?
Sure. And per stirpes is the old Latin term that law is filled with a bunch of old dumb Latin terms. This is one of them. Per stirpes is the designation by how things pass after your death. It also works as wills too. A will, your will says I give everything to my three children equally, the state law automatically assumes it's per stirpes. So per stirpes is to take into account what happens if one of your beneficiaries passes away before you. Let's say you have two children, child Adam and Billy, and Billy has a kid of his own named Charlie. Well, if your will leaves everything, or your beneficiary designation leaves everything to Adam and Billy is equally, 50-50 each, then that's fine. What if Billy passes away before you do? So you're left with your child Adam and your grandchild Charlie. Well, in this case, upon your death, Adam gets his 50%, and Billy's 50% passes by blood to his next of kin, which means Charlie. It doesn't go to his spouse, or if he had left one behind, it goes directly to his kids. So if Billy had three kids, they would all get one-third each of Billy's 50% share. And you can do the math on how that would work to your individual situation. That's kind of the default way of how things are divided upon death if you have someone beneficiary who dies before you do.
Very good. Very good. Yeah. I see that a lot. It's a lot to digest there. But in essence, you have somebody standing in the shoes of who you named, right, and they're getting their representative portion.
Right. The kids of whoever dies before you do just takes their parents' share, or
right,
steps up to that level.
Right. Okay. And I think in most instances, I can't think of an instance where you wouldn't want to check that box if
right,
they have children.
Occasionally people do it the old way per capita, which would say that all the money just goes to whomever's still living. So
right,
in that earlier scenario, Adam would get all of the money and nothing would go to Billy's kids.
Right.
But some have had clients late that election in their wills, but it's very rare.
Yeah. Yeah. By the same token, if Adam and Billy die, okay, those are the two children in your scenario, right?
Right?
And Billy has one child and Adam has 10. They each get 1/11th.
Right.
Yeah. So they would not stand in the shoes of their parent. I think it's very interesting and something that a lot of folks don't pay attention to.
Exactly.
But the gravity of that and the outcome of that can be profound. All right. We wanted to talk about a few examples and some things we've come across recently. I think I was sharing with you before the show. We have a client, she serves as power of attorney for an elderly lady. The elderly lady is incompetent and cannot execute a last will and testament, nor can she articulate her thoughts, okay? Mm-hmm. So no attorney is going to draft and have her execute a last will and testament. She did, however, put an account in place that has a TOD designation. The person that is serving for this lady as power of attorney has a conundrum because she is named TOD. She is named as a beneficiary in the TOD account, and there are lots of assets that are not in that account. And, you know, my question, you know, or, you know, if we can deliver advice, if that is the only account, or let's say that is the only vessel that has any sort of distribution wishes of the, you know, of the owner of the assets, should this person start putting money in the TOD account?
If that's the only asset that has distribution wishes through a TOD, then no, I don't believe so, because, I mean, if she has multiple assets and this is the only one with the TOD beneficiary designation, then clearly that's the one she wanted to go to this person.
Mm-hmm.
And the other assets can go to whomever her intestate heirs at law are,
right.
You know, children, cousins, aunts, uncles, whoever. So then to put everything in that one account just so it all goes to this one individual would be unethical.
Right. Right. Okay. So you wouldn't start putting everything in there just because that's the only one that articulates.
Certainly not.
Those wishes. Okay. Very, very interesting. Let's talk about the Secure Act 2020 and how that has changed estate planning mm-hmm. in some ways. I think one of the biggest changes from the Secure Act of 2020 is the elimination of the stretch IRAs.
Right.
And the invocation of the 10-year rule, and the 10-year rule being whoever, and we need to get this right, but I'm going to say in most cases, if you're not leaving it to your spouse or if your spouse predeceases you and you're leaving it to your children, those children, in most instances, if they're over 18 years old when they receive it,
or they're not disabled,
and when most of us die, our children have reached the age of majority,
right.
And there are some children that are disabled. But under normal circumstances, the children that receive the IRA that now have an inherited or beneficiary IRA have to empty that account in 10 years. That is a huge change.
Mm-hmm.
Are you incorporating any estate planning ideas into your practice in addressing that 10-year rule?
Well, a lot of it goes hand in hand with trusts. A lot of people name their trust as a beneficiary of their IRA, for example. If you have for spendthrift issues, if you want the money in your IRA to go to children that, for whatever reason, you don't want them to have the money outright, it goes in a trust to be doled out in whatever terms the trust says.
Right.
But with this in place, you know, the money just can't stay in the name of the IRA and then hand or into the trust indefinitely. It has to all be distributed within 10 years.
Right.
So you can't do the old, you know, the money, he can get a lifetime income from the IRA for as long as he lives, and upon his death, the rest of it goes to so-and-so. It has to be distributed out within 10 years.
Right. And really, I think that goes, that goes under the heading of, or under the responsibility of perhaps your investment advisor. And if you know that your children, let's say you have one, two, maybe three children, and you have this big IRA, and it's a traditional IRA, and it has to be emptied in 10 years, that is going to throw out a lot of income to these children in 10 years. Again, it's going to be gone 10 years after your death. One of the planning things that we do now is we've really stepped up the Roth conversions.
Mm-hmm.
I think estate planning extends to many things and includes us investment advisors. And if you have traditional balances, if you're able to endure the sting of paying ordinary income taxes on what would be called a Roth conversion during your lifetime, you should strongly consider that, because think about this. You have a large traditional IRA. You and your spouse, if you're married, pass away in your 80s, and you're leaving it to your children that are in their 50s, maybe mid-50s, late-50s. It doesn't matter what their age are or what their age is. But you're leaving it to them, and they're in their peak earning years, and you're throwing all this income on top of what they're already making in their jobs. And let's say they're in their 50s and they've got to take it out in 10 years and they have no plans to retire, 55 to 65, you know, wouldn't it have been great to have taken a little sting out of the ordinary income or ordinary income tax treatment of the traditional IRA by doing a Roth conversion during your own lifetime. It's a little complicated. We don't know. We do a lot. We probably do over 100 Roth conversions a year, and I don't see the income tax treatment going forward getting any better for anyone.
No.
Yeah. So federal income taxes right now, I think, are a gift, and you got to make sure that, you know, I would think if you're considering doing a Roth conversion, that perhaps you're no longer working at your own job, and maybe if it's that little window of time before you're taking Social Security or your RMDs, you can squeeze some money out every year up right until then. And what a great opportunity. And you know what? If you don't use it that year, you lose it. So anyway, that's something we're doing a lot of. How about estate planning as it involves gifting, specifically charitable gifting? Would you recommend that you use IRA assets to make charitable gifts or possibly highly appreciated stock as part of your charitable gifting going forward, and maybe as a continuum? You know, these folks that are giving money annually, you know, you don't have to put it in the basket every Sunday.
Right.
If it's an amount you want to gift and you have highly appreciated stock or perhaps qualified plan money that that you think you may not need or want to give to your possibly your church or any 501c3, those are great assets if you're charitably inclined to gift. Gifting during your lifetime, you're limited to individuals, $15,000 per year. Mm-hmm. That's not going to help if you're needing to get assets out of your estate. So, all right. We're going to talk a little bit about tax changes, things that we see that, you know, we're not going to predict anything, but I think we can count on our ordinary income taxes going up. Okay, in most cases, there's a lot of discussion about capital gains treatment. That's another one that is possibly going up. Nick, what do you think? Putting you on the spot, but what do you think will happen with the step up in cost basis?
I think the step up is more likely to stay as is. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of resistance in Congress to changing step up, whereas there's much less resistance to raising income taxes and other such things. Yeah. I think the step up is, I won't say it's 100% safe, but it's safer than most other things in this realm.
Right. So let's back up and explain the step up in basis and what it is. Go ahead. All right. I'm gonna cover for Nick here. He's
coughing.
Anyway, the step up in basis. When you die, okay, and you have highly appreciated assets, the beneficiaries receive a step up in basis, and this is for non-qualified money that is not in an IRA, because guess what? If it's in an IRA, Roth, traditional, or any qualified plan, you don't care. Okay, there are no capital gain consequences. But in a non-qualified account, or if it's a piece of property, a piece of real estate, when you die, your beneficiaries receive a step-up in cost basis that is equal to the date-of-death value of that asset. That's a beautiful thing. Oh, by the way, you can also choose alternate date of death, which is 6 months later, and that would become the new or step-up in basis that would be applied to what is now an asset owned by the beneficiary. So, as they say, all capital gains are wiped out at death. That's very true. And there might be some instances where they're not completely wiped out if it's jointly owned property or tenants in common. But for all intents and purposes, all capital gains are wiped out at death. That's a nice time to really kind of clean things up, right?
Right.
Everybody knows what their cost basis is. It's what it was worth upon the demise of the person that left this property to me. Pretty easy to identify. You have these multi-generational assets. You know, let's say family, I don't know, vacation homes. You have, farms, all these properties where the cost basis is not readily identifiable. And it's a nice time to set that amount using date of death pricing or alternate date of death pricing. Okay. So listen, Nick, is there anything else you want to share with our listeners before we go away for the week?
I would just like to emphasize the importance of getting these documents done properly. You know, a lot of people try to do it themselves, save a little money by finding forms online or other such sources, and I've seen so many times where that goes horribly wrong because their forms were out of date or not filled out correctly. So I'd always tell people, if you have a short in your electrical system at your house, you'd probably look up on Google how to fix it, but you've also wound up killing yourself. So it's better just to hire a licensed electrician, have them take care of it.
Yeah.
Same thing applies to your estate
plan. You can find anything on the internet, but don't go down that road. Not for your estate plan, right?
Right.
Okay. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in this week. We will talk with you next week. Have a great week.